Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Welcome to this is our third Monday, so the beginning of week three or the end of week two of the 21-day equity challenge. The sort of overall theme this week was wealth and housing. Any sort of initial reactions to the material that we covered on wealth and housing this week?
I learned a little bit about redlining last year when your wife actually opened up some links for me that I went and checked out over on Franklin at the middle school, I think I went to. And I was astounded, but the fact that it's still happening that long ago and it's still happening today, nail got caught on my shirt, like, oh, okay. Just shocks me that there can be people that know what they're doing to set things up like that, where you literally can't get a loan, or they know which area is low income and they keep it that way so that it can't be renewed or grow with the city. And then for me, the big aha moment was the fact that I-235 was put right through the Black city off of Center Street. I had no idea. And it looked like a really vital part of the city. So that was shocking to me.
That had a lot to do with the decline of Cottage Grove Church. When they put the freeway through,
yeah.
I also learned that it was the government that created the redlining. I thought it was just the banks came up with that, but it was the government that created it.
Yeah, that's something that I wouldn't necessarily have thought about being a government program, and it was sort of a pro-bank government program, so it was sort of a shared thing there. But I was very struck by both kind of the understanding of redlining when I first began to learn about it, and then the situation with Center Street that's just hard to fathom.
Yeah, and they did it on purpose. I mean, really.
Right.
And it said they told some of the people not to make improvements on your house because they were going to be buying it in a few years. So they let the houses run down. So then when they went to buy the houses for the freeway, they didn't get nearly as much money from them because they were more run down.
And even if they weren't run down, they only offered them a minimal amount. So can you imagine losing your home and then having to find another home, but without equity or finances or any means to do that? And that still happens today when they put a road through farmland, splitting farmland up. And it just amazed me that people knew what they were doing.
It's in circumstances like this that the old joke, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, makes more sense.
Yeah.
And then all the Black businesses were on Center Street, and they kind of wiped out all of those. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. I was raised knowing that if I worked hard and I did my best, I'd be okay. But then you learn that that's not true, that that's really a white thing, that I had background and family to support me and get me there. That if everything's against you, that doesn't matter how hard you work.
Yeah, so
that's what I learned this week.
Yeah. So give us kind of the connection between redlining and wealth equity. How do do those two things end up going together? Why are we talking about redlining at the same time as we're talking about wealth equity or inequity?
You're muted, Warren.
Thank you. I'm done eating now. Most people pay a fairly large amount each month for housing. Now, it can either be rental or it can be homeownership. And generally, homeownership leads to equity in real estate, which is the main portion of a family's net worth. As you and I all know, buying automobiles goes the other direction. It's the worst thing you can spend money on, be it new or used or whatever. And we're talking about these businesses that go out. Like my fear is that somebody hits my 2005 Impala and they'll total it out for $1,500, but I got a $2,000 transmission in it. I just put in, I got tire seat, and then I've got my $1,500 or $2,000, whatever. But anyway, if you're not paying on a mortgage, a lot of people will not accumulate too much net worth because of everything they're spending their money on. Mortgages traditionally are about the only one that really helps them have some. And in my particular case, you know, I bought a small house in West Des Moines because they were busing kids in Des Moines, Iowa. And I like to have bought a home at 44th and Franklin, because I was working at Calvin Manor at the time, but I didn't want my kids to get on the bus when Perkins School was a half a block away. I had no idea they'd go there. So anyway, by buying a house in West Des Moines, 5 years later, that $20,000 house was a $45,000 house. You know, there's where that is almost like magic. You know, I had $25,000 that just came because I happened to buy a piece of property, and it wasn't redlined, obviously. And that allowed me to get in the house we're in now. More than you wanted to know, probably.
No, that sounds exactly right. And in terms of the way that being able to get a mortgage affects whether you can eventually accumulate wealth. And that, you know, that's almost hard to imagine, isn't it? That those two things would go together in such a big way. And so here we've got, this is the Des Moines redlining map. So this is the city of Des Moines. And I'll get you the slightly bigger version of this here. Did that get bigger or am I still in the same?
It's bigger.
Excellent. Good work, everybody.
Is there a year for this?
I was about to try to zoom in and see if I could get that. This takes a moment to zoom in here. This is going to be the, there we go, 1931.
Oh.
1931. Redlining is the outgrowth of a New Deal program. This is what happened when the problem was that it was hard to convince banks to write mortgages, and so the federal government said, "Okay, we want to encourage banks to write mortgages. So what we're going to do is we're going to help them manage their risk." And so they said, you're going to manage your risk by knowing that when you write a loan, that house is going to retain its value. And so they created these maps, and we'll find a nice representative area here that some of y'all may be familiar with. And unfortunately, I've only got these two Zoom levels, but what you've got here, there's North High School over there on the right-hand side. You've got Drake University is right down in this neck of the woods. And so what you've got is a nice A area up here. This is property that is going to hold its value. We just know that for sure. And then the B and the C, a little bit less and a little bit less. And then this area down here, this is the red area. We don't expect these to hold their value at all. And you can tell as well that this is before the freeway came through. So the freeway, I-235 headed from west to east, came along here, dodges the cemetery, comes right up along here, goes through downtown, or goes north of downtown anyway. That Center Street neighborhood that that we talked about is right down in here, that business district. So the sort of the center of Black wealth and culture was right here. And so the adjoining neighborhood gets cut in half by the freeway. Cottage Grove Church is right here. So you can see that that whole area here, I'm going to point to it with my hand, that'll help. That this whole area not only got cut in half, but it was easy to cut in half because you knew that those properties had already lost their value. And so again, this is a New Deal program because, as Warren said, we knew that that owning a house builds wealth. And we knew that at the close of the Great Depression, we understood that that banks were not writing mortgages as well as they should. So so home ownership was lower than the New Deal wanted anyway. And then so the National Housing Act provided subsidies to lower interest rates. So mortgage interest rates used to be much higher than they are now. And then these maps to indicate where housing stock would retain its value. This is all on the Undesign Des Moines website. And you can see here on the main map page, we can click here to get the area descriptions. And that's the original from 1931. Descriptions of each area. So they talk about the families that live in that area. So, you know, what's their type of employment? What's the type of structures that the houses are made of? What are their races? How long have they lived in town and so forth? So with or without the intent of sort of enshrining Jim Crow in the housing makeup of the city, redlining was explicitly racist. So a neighborhood, this is Richard Rothstein in The Color of Law, a neighborhood earned a red color if African Americans lived in it, even if it was a solid middle-class neighborhood of single-family homes. So the prediction being made by the redlining manual was that if Black people live in the neighborhood, housing values are going to go down. Then banks are encouraged to only in the rarest of circumstances write mortgages for the purchase of those homes. So what happens to the value of housing in those neighborhoods?
Well, they would not appreciate in value, and probably would actually decline because right. They're not saleable.
Right, and they're not saleable because you can't get what to buy one?
Mortgage.
A mortgage. And so it becomes, at the very least, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Even if there's no nefarious intent. Now, there probably was also nefarious intent, because this was at the time when there was sort of continuing Jim Crow legislation, particularly explicit in the South, but implicitly throughout the country. And part of the sort of the way that national political alliances have historically worked in the United States is that you find a way to bring white people together around an idea or a candidate by putting black people on the other side of it. That has happened again and again, just as a dynamic in sort of the political life of the United States. So I'm going to say that there was, in fact, not only explicit racism baked in, but that it was the way we often think about racism, which is that my thoughts are biased and my heart is biased, and so I'm going to specifically write those people out. But part of the point is that at least once those red lines got drawn, whether they were drawn prescriptively as saying, we want to make sure all the black people stay in their place so that the white people can all feel like, you know, they've got sort of an economic advantage to being in their own neighborhoods. Even if there was no sort of explicit racist animus in putting these lines together, once they happened, the system created an unequal wealth distribution, even if there had been equality before. Now, there wasn't a balance of wealth equity before, and the wealth inequality has continued. You can certainly see, as we talked about, the where the freeway went. This A1 area, this was sort of unfortunately in the way. We had to put a freeway through some part of this. But then, boy, once we get up here, you can watch the freeway sort of dive through here and then come up here. And then what does it do? It goes on the east side of the tracks up there, right? So dives up here, and you can see where I-235 is going to go on this map even before it happened. It remains the case that, and this is again from the materials on the website, black homeowners are nearly 5 times more likely to own a home in a formerly redlined area, which means they have diminished home equity and is a major driving factor in overall economic inequality.
What do we know about the areas labeled D3 and D4?
Yeah, folks, what do you know about the areas labeled D3 down here and D4 over here? So here's the state fairgrounds right up here. So this is all south of the fairgrounds. And this is sort of the east side of, this is probably about, what is this? Probably about East 14th-ish, around in there. So down on the south side of the river. What do you know about those areas?
Well, I would suspect a flood zone at one time. Anything east of the ballpark where the two rivers merge at the ballpark, yeah, that going east, I'm sure at one time that was flood prone to beat the dam until they finally put some levees in.
Well, I was thinking they used to call that the Southeast Bottoms, which is not a real nice term.
What do we know about the ethnicity down there?
Italian, wasn't it?
Italian and other lower class white. do you have anything in your studies that show whether they intentionally discriminated against Italian and lower class white, or was it exclusively black we were going after?
Let's pull up the area descriptions, shall we? So what are we looking at? D3 and D4. And we'll just give this a little read. All right, so we're down in the D's now. D3. Loans up to 50% of a conservative appraisal. That's about as generous as they'll go on one of these red zones. Type of inhabitant consists mostly of the Italian race. Considerable rehabilitation. So this is one of these are going to be some sort of self-reinforcing dynamics, and you can see there sort of the question of sort of what do Italians qualify for? Italians and Irish both, particularly at this point in the 20th century, it was debatable whether you would sort of not were Italians and Irish black, but had they been fully assimilated, we used that word last week, right? Had they been fully assimilated into whiteness and what it's for. The South Bottoms, D4, again, that's the, get the other map here. D4, that's over on the east side of the river or the north side of the river, depending on how it's flowing at that point. And let's see, the South Bottoms rather, again, don't lend more than half the property value. And mixed laboring class with some colored. So notice that equivalency there. Laboring and colored. They're not the same thing, but those are both things that are going to draw down the value of the property under the logic of redlining here. So John, I'm going to say that this wasn't exclusively anti-black. I think that's a fair point. I'm not going to say that this was ever not anti-black. Italians who had sort of proven themselves, I'm betting, if they, you know, had been in the country for long enough that you didn't think of them as Italian, or if they had the kind of jobs that you didn't necessarily think of as Italian, probably didn't draw their neighborhood directly into the red as soon as they got there.
I believe the unifying principle is that the people in D4, since that's the one with mixed occupation, were still poor folks. And I think that discrimination against poor folks is maybe the underlying problem with blacks. Now, the question we could then ask is, why were the Italians able to move to much better areas in another generation or so, and the blacks still weren't?
Why was that?
I would assume it's discrimination. There are those who would say that black people are lazy or thieves or whatever, and that's why they're disrespected. I, of course, don't buy into that, but it comes out that way. Whatever you want to call it, it still comes out that way.
So, sorry, go ahead, Warren.
One thing that's typical in the Italian culture is if you had a business, you often lived above your business. And also you frequently had multiple generations living under the same roof. And I think maybe They just kind of maybe had their own financing that the Italians would loan money to other Italians that they felt comfortable were not a risk. It wasn't a lot of money, but like I say, by consolidating and having, you know, three generations living in the same home, or you had your business on the ground level and you lived above it, you didn't have a business and a second property you lived in. They were doing that. One comment I want to make on that D3, I don't know when the packing houses came, but even until recently, that can have some terrible odor in that part of the city. I don't know.
So as I was beginning some of the just sort of what do I need to know to even sort of dive into this equity challenge, I did come across someone who looked at a lot of maps like this and pointed out, hey, do you notice that he found this worldwide. He said, do you notice that the poor part of town is always on the east side? And it is for exactly the reason that Warren just said. Now that's geography, right? That's physical geography. We can talk about how that relates to sort of the social geography. But physical geography, the poor part of town is on the east side, and Warren just said exactly why. Because what direction do the prevailing winds blow from?
Okay, I hadn't thought of that, yeah.
And because of the direction that the earth rotates, that's universally true. So everywhere in the world, the prevailing winds are generally from the west. You know, they may be a little bit more northerly, a bit more southerly, you know, seasonal variations and so forth. But the upper level winds, you know, your weather always blows in from the west, unless the fronts are doing something weird because we're in Iowa. You'll definitely find as you look at the redlining map that the red areas are all on the east. And it was probably already the case in 1931 when the map was drawn that the ethnic composition of those neighborhoods was sorted by class, by economics, and by race. John, I want to keep pushing on the question of whether it is primarily class or primarily race. And time and time again, we find that race has an effect regardless of economic status. So again and again, It's not that race and economics are disconnected from each other, but again and again you find, you know, as a, you know, when you do the statistics to sort of single out the variables and figure out which one is sort of which one is more dominant in the effect that you're talking about. Again and again, race has an impact that sort of controls more than economic class controls. There was a process in the sort of the turn of the 20th century, so about 40 years from say 1880 to about 1920, 1930-ish, the way that government tracked things like crime statistics changed, and they changed in a way that assimilated Italians and Irish without even asking. When you look at sociologists studying why do people commit crimes from about 1890, 1900, 1910, they're going to look at why do white people commit crimes, or why do people in general commit crimes? And then more specifically, why do Irish people commit crimes? Why do Italian people commit crimes? Why do Black people commit crimes? Why do Native American people commit crimes? And then they quit counting Irish and Italian separately. And so their criminality, so to speak, disappeared because we no longer counted it. We continued to count African-American criminality and Native American criminality and the sort of umbrella term Hispanic didn't really exist at the time that these statistics were being done, but these other groups, yeah.
Italian and Irish became white then?
Effectively, yeah. Not as if you would necessarily have lumped them in some other racial grouping as we think of racial groupings today. Although you saw in the description of area D3, right? That type of inhabitant consists mostly of the Italian what?
Working
race.
Class.
Class.
Italian race is the okay. word in the document from 1931. So that means that the word race has changed what it means over time as well, right? It means that the word race, which we think of predominantly kind of which continent did your ancestors live on, right? Even then, you know, we're a little fuzzier about that, right? Like we'll talk about Africans as being generally dark-skinned and generally from the Sahara down. And then we'll talk about Arabs who are sort of, you know, Middle Eastern, but half of that goes across Northern Africa. And so we sort of differentiate these races in a way that doesn't necessarily make any geographic, even linguistic sense, right? But it's part of how we have just inherited these concepts. My point being that the concepts are changeable, that the concepts can mean sort of one thing, race can mean one thing. In 1931, that area on the south and west side of the Des Moines River, south of the Raccoon River, that area was predominantly inhabited by the Italian race, which is a concept that just doesn't make any sense to us anymore, because the word race no longer means that you can separate out the Italians from the rest of Europe.
Do they still do things like redlining today? When you go get a mortgage, is your neighborhood got a description like this somewhere?
That's a great question, isn't it?
How do you find that out?
How do you find that out?
I didn't know about this until somebody made a bulletin board.
Right.
Like, oh.
Yeah, so Warren, you mentioned that we'll set aside busing for right now. Busing is it's founded actually, the need for busing is founded on this logic of redlining. But I showed you the Des Moines map because the West Des Moines map didn't exist. It was West Des Moines was too small to sort of factor into this this national housing program. But Warren, you've lived in that little house in West Des Moines for a good little while here. What can you take from the logic of redlining in Des Moines, where it was literally written on a map as a federally administered bank policy? What can you take from that logic and help you make sense of the neighborhood that your house is in West Des Moines?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but I'm surprised that not only did they have this map, but they had a written description. And back to Deb's question is, does it happen today? Well, It does, but you won't find anything that you could in writing. It's a kind of a, what should we say, good old boys club, spoken word, but nothing written, and obviously no maps.
And so when we were buying our house in Valley Junction, I was teaching at Phoenix Elementary School on 4th and Locust, right down in Valley Junction. And the realtor was showing us a house on 10th Street. And she said, we said we were looking at one on 7th as well. And she said, you don't want to live on 7th because then your kids would go to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Well, I taught there, so I knew the school pretty well. And I said, well, what would be wrong with that? And she said, oh, you want to move on this house on 10th Street that I'm selling because they'd go to Rex Mathis. You don't want to live in the Valley Junction area. Well, we continued to look and continued to get that from different realtors that were telling homeowners with kids or young couples that were going to have kids that looked like they would have kids soon, not to live in the Valley Junction area because of Phoenix Elementary.
And there was that code for a great school.
There was nothing wrong with it, but it was where there were many different races, whereas everything west of there was white middle class.
Well, I suspect the realtors and the lenders were in cahoots and had their ideas of how they wanted this expanding Valley Junction, later known as West Des Moines, to play out. And it is continued to be our, what would that be, the extreme southeast corner of West Des Moines, i.e. the Valley Junction area, is where the less expensive houses, although I have to give them credit, after the flood of 93, a lot of homeowners in that area really have improved their houses, as opposed to, I couldn't handle being in a floodplain. But I'm real pleased on lack of blight in West Des Moines, specifically the Valley Junction, I don't know, from 8th Street to 63rd and from Grand Avenue to Railroad, you know, that and I know your Phoenix school, I never thought about that being an issue, but I think you'd have a tough time finding anything in a realtor's office that would prove that. It was all kept up here in the agents and they're referring them to lenders. The same lenders are in the same playbook, but nothing in writing, nothing that in court could be produced in writing.
So I'm curious about something. Here's Deb's realtor saying, oh, you don't want to live in the neighborhood where your kids would go to Phoenix Elementary. We talked about when we were setting the ground rules for our conversations together around this, that one of the things that we wanted to do for each other is to continually assume positive intent. So when somebody says something that that sounds like it just, oh, grates on us, or that embodies some other either inherited prejudice or whatever it may be. When we hear something from somebody else, we want to assume that they have some kind of positive, benevolent intent. Somebody give me a positive, benevolent intent that Deb's realtor could have been exercising when she said, you don't want to buy this house in this neighborhood because this neighborhood is in the Phoenix Elementary attendance area. What was that realtor saving Deb from?
Property value not increasing. I live in what I think is a pretty nice house, but it's 100 years old. And it's not nearly as young as some of the houses 10, 15 blocks west. Our house, if you suddenly uprooted it and put it on a lot west of 42nd Street, would be worth twice what it is.
Why?
And that is, well, perceptions feed reality or reality feeds perceptions. Now, if you want to say the perception is we might have black people in the neighborhood, we have a few. If you want to say the perception is that Callanan Junior High is nothing but trouble sometimes, that's correct. But then you're going to have to try to get into why that is. And whether race is cause or effect on that. But realtors always want to sell properties and they want to be able to get them financed. And the financing is going to come from a bank that can't afford to just put on blinders and say, these seem to be nice people. I'm going to lend them 95% to value, even though they're in a cruddy neighborhood. They can't and they won't. And I don't think you can expect them to.
So my question was, why does the bank perceive it to be a cruddy neighborhood? Either the neighborhood you live in or the neighborhood that Deb was trying to purchase in, where she worked.
I'm back to saying trend of property values. Now, why that is the case is what we can debate for the next 1,000 years, and so can all the people in Washington. But my older kid moved to Waukee. Now, she didn't move to Waukee because she said, oh, there aren't going to be as many people of color. She moved there because the schools were better. Well, better financed has something to do with it. And because property values will go up and up and up for the foreseeable future. Now, why people think that a given property is worth less than something else has to be due to factors we would like to be blind to, but I maintain are there all the time.
So does the bank need to hate black people in order to see that the market forces tend to drive property values down when the tipping point seems to be about 10%. So statistically, if a neighborhood becomes a little bit more than 10% black, property values in that neighborhood go down. So there's your trend of property values. There seems to be a proximate cause, sort of the thing that you can see happening is more black people move into the neighborhood and the property values go down. Who needs to hate black people in order for that to happen?
I don't know that anyone has to hate them, but I think they have to disrespect them. Somebody Who? Does, and that somebody is probably other homeowners, aided heavily by the banking and finance industry.
Now, the bank would not push those property values down if they didn't have an incentive. Go ahead, Deb.
Just my mom and dad live on the south side of Chicago, right outside the city limits. And my mom told me the other day, there's a house for sale next door to us. And if those black people that looked at it the other day buy it, our property values are going to go down a lot. And we have to really worry about that. It's not that we're racist. Just stop talking. They're 86. I'm not going to change their views.
So who needs to be racist?
Where does that come from?
Yeah, who needs to be racist in order for those property values to go down?
All of us.
And
the banks and the businesses, everybody.
So you're a realtor saying, if you buy a house over in that neighborhood, it's not going to hold value nearly as well as this house over on 10th Street. She may or may not have actually said that to you, but she easily could have, right?
What she meant.
And she probably
yeah.
would have been correct, right?
Right.
She would have been factually correct,
right?
Because she's seen the trend of property values. Right. Or she could look at John's house and an identical house 7 blocks over and say, your house is not going to hold that much value, but this house over here that's effectively the same is going to hold value better or is going to appreciate in value. Does that realtor need to be racist to know that?
Counter question, does the realtor need to be explicitly racist or just de facto racist, meaning recognizing that facts is facts is facts? I don't have an answer. That's the question I think we're considering.
I don't know. Yeah.
So where I'm trying to go with this is to push us away from the idea that racism is a thing that we think. I want to push us away from the idea that racism is a thing that we think. I can use another example of this is sexism, a particular kind of sexualized sexism. When I waited tables, I worked for tips, right? So I got paid whatever, in general, people thought I was worth. I got paid in each instance whatever that particular table of people thought I was worth. But I got paid in general what people in general thought I was worth. And there is a visible statistical difference in the amount of money people make based on gender and based on sort of broadly culturally accepted attractiveness in the hospitality industry. Who needs to be sexist or smarmy for that to happen? Nobody in particular, and everybody all at once. And you know, there have been studies to try to sort out what are the factors involved in, you know, how people tip various, various sets of people. This was in the news just recently, how people choose a newscast to watch based on what they think of the anchor in whatever subjective ways that they choose to think of the anchor. So they're, again and again, we have these biased ways that the world is set up, the ways that markets are set up. And we're talking here today about housing and wealth accumulation and the particular racism built into that. That nobody in particular needs to be racist in order for that, you know, needs to be consciously racist in order for this system to continue working. In order to know, oh, well, you know, if I can help it, I'm going to buy the house over on 10th Street rather than the house on 7th Street. Or if I can help it, I'm going to buy the house where I don't even have kids anymore, but the next kids who, you know, in the family that buys this house, their kids are going to go to a better school, whatever better is code for, right? Those kids are going to go to this school. And so this house is going to retain value. So I'm going to go there.
And isn't that the very nature of white privilege, that it's so pervasive and whatever the word for is that word for it is that fish don't know what water is, because it's just there. There's a right word for that. And I think as to where to buy a house and where property values are going to increase and whether to go to Phoenix or Rex Mathis, a lot of it is assumption, and I might call it bias, but it's, a lot of it is going to be unconscious bias, which we will then seek to deny that exists.
So I'm not going to deny that unconscious bias exists, but I'm going to say that for these purposes, particularly for talking about wealth and even for talking about redlining in the context of any given home buyer's decision, I'm going to say that unconscious bias is way less important than the landscape that we're in. I think the landscape that we're in shapes so much about how these long-term patterns of wealth distribution happen.
What do you mean by landscape? I'm not sure I follow.
The Well, we could talk about the literal landscape marked out on those maps, the sort of, you know, the decision matrix of, you know, how do I decide which house I want to buy? You know, I want to be close to my job. I want to have, you know, I want to know where my kids are going to go to school. I want to make sure that I can, you know, that I can get a good mortgage at good rates. I want to make sure that I can sell the house later for more than I bought it for. You know, any of those pieces that would go into a decision, those are all, you could describe those all as sort of the landscape in which you're making the decision. And so kind of independent of what you want, or particularly independent of how you want your relationships with people of other races to be, you're going to make those decisions, and you're going to know that there's a benefit or a drawback to making some of those decisions. Part of what white privilege does to reinforce itself is that it sets us up with generally pretty good mortgage rates and generally pretty good access to, you know, buying a home in a neighborhood of our choosing. And so it means that partly we have to work against ourselves in order to change those patterns, because the path of least resistance is to continue really reinforcing those red line maps. There are some dynamics that stir those red line maps, like gentrification, which is its own problem. And that's when enough white people realize that a formerly or predominantly people of color neighborhood all of a sudden is kind of having its generational turnover in terms of who owns the properties there. And white people love that kind of stuff and have a tendency to buy up houses in a formerly black neighborhood, drive up the property values, which tends to drive out the rest of the black people living there. And it's kind of another damaging urban renewal without necessarily, although sometimes, the top-down government program. So if you watched the Center Street documentary, or the little plug for the Center Street documentary, I'd love to see a finished documentary come of that. That was a sort of government-structured, top-down urban revitalization or urban renewal. And they identified these three neighborhoods, all of which were redlined originally back in the 30s, and said, okay, we're going to tear these two down. We're going to rehab this one and it's going to be great. Which is when Center Street as a business district got cleared out. And when the residential neighborhood got cut in half and cleared out. So that's a top down, we're going to change this whole thing. There are other ways that those neighborhoods get broken up and really sort of taken apart in some really, really painful ways. And there's, even without any one of us thinking that that's how it should be, that's how it is, because it's been that way for 90 years. That red line map is 89 years old, right? So it's older than any one of us. It has been that way our entire life, even before we knew that we might live in Des Moines or West Des Moines. And so that's why it takes so much work to try to reshape any of these dynamics. And we got there without a one of us needing to be racist to make it happen. Setting aside that we all are, right? Setting aside that we have our own you know, inherited racism and our own implicit bias and all of those pieces. We are still living in this redlined, racially segregated world that is now economically reinforced rather than being reinforced by differential government laws.
Well, just a follow-up comment kind of about John's daughter electing to go to Waukee. When I was her age, I was probably more interested in my first home getting me towards accumulating some net worth as opposed to making a social statement on I will deliberately buy a home in a C, maybe a C zoned area. I'm not sure I would go to the D. For example, I think the current president of DMACC lives in an area not too far from, help me, where Old Dowling used to be, that part, 8th and College, I think. I don't think it's widely known, and I'm not 100% sure of that. But here's a guy that's making, you know, a pretty good salary. But I appreciate his willingness to do that. But he doesn't have any kids at his age, you know, in elementary school or high school. See, that's not a factor. But he goes to church in that neighborhood, and I think he lives in that neighborhood as a kind of a social statement. But I, in my late 20s, early 30s, would probably opt to go someplace and I wasn't that enamored with West Des Moines. I liked Beaverdale because I worked at Calvin Manor, and I liked Beaverdale. I could have lived in Urbandale. You know, Waukee at that time was a little country town. You know, I've been in this house 43 years, you know. I'm not one to move, but I think in the way what I've been talking about, the way John and Tammy raised their daughters, I'm sure they are very conscious about redlining and different things. But I would not be critical of her, John, because at that age I would have done the same thing. Because as our first statement in the evening is, usually our home purchase leads to accumulating some net worth.
I'm not being critical. I don't think you mean that. It was just the way it was, but they're smart enough that if they want to live in an area that gives maximum opportunity for their kids, they have to be complicit in that some way, as we all are complicit in this system. Mm-hmm. Maybe the president of DMACC is saying, I won't be complicit any more than I have to.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I had bought that house I was telling you about, John, my kids would have gone to Perkins Elementary, they would have gone to Franklin Junior High, and they would have gone to Roosevelt High School. But coming from Marshalltown, I always thought Roosevelt High School was a pretty nice school, you know, and I didn't know that much about Franklin. But see, I had no... That was 19, as in early 70s. I didn't have any qualms about them going to Franklin Junior High and then feeding into Roosevelt and living in the Beaverdale area.
So part of what we're getting at is that you're absolutely right. The factors that lead this this continued process of kind of the knock-on effects of redlining, and the continued sort of the continued process of inequity in wealth distribution as a racial fact in the country. These happen again, independent of whether the people involved in doing it have any particular racial antipathy. It really doesn't matter how people feel in order to make these things happen. And certainly it doesn't matter how any particular person feels in order to make these things happen, because it is perfectly understandable by why someone would feel like, you know, I wanna live in Waukee where, you know, things are growing and housing values are going up, and I know certain things about the schools and so on and so forth. And it could even be as simple as there's an age of house that I like in Waukee versus an age of house that I don't like in Des Moines. And so there are these dynamics that are already there. And that's what I mean when I say landscape, that there are these pieces that are already in place, and they create forces that tend to sort people racially without any of those people even realizing that they're sorting themselves racially. Without even realizing that it's happening, let alone asking for it. Because these forces are already there. And in order to undo this system, in order to make this system something else, means that those forces either have to be changed or resisted. And the president of DMACC has perhaps the place in life and the sort of level of social and economic privilege to be able to say, you know what, I don't need to live in you know, the west edge of Waukee. I don't need to make my house my primary investment asset. You know, imagine not needing to make your house your nest egg. So there are places where privilege, you know, folks can use their privilege by, in order to say, I'm not going to play this game according to these rules anymore. I have the option to step out. You know, somebody just establishing their career and just establishing their independent household doesn't have really as many options. They may have less to lose. But the upside opportunity of being in this place versus that place, even just as an economic matter, can be overwhelming, and can get in the way of even feeling like you have these other options. So that's going to be one of the places where, you know, as we turn and look at, you know, healthcare and education next week, as we continue looking at the dynamics that have created these inequities, we have to continue recognizing that we didn't necessarily have to ask for these in order for them to happen. And we can say, you know what, we have certain kinds of privilege. We either have accumulated money that we can invest in partnerships with neighborhoods, or we have accumulated influence because, you know, some people get quicker calls back from their city council people than other people do. Or we have the sort of handles in different parts of life that we can say, you know what, I'd like to play a different game for a while. I'd like to try something different and see how this goes. So one of the days last week had the challenge of contacting your city council or your planning and zoning board. So John and I have the same city council and planning and zoning board. Although I think we have different city council people, but you know, we've got four different city councils that, you know, folks on this small conversation that we have are constituents of. And city councils have a kind of leverage over this that they may not even realize. And they certainly may not realize that folks who look like us actually want something to change. So there are places like that, without even necessarily telling you what the right politics are there, right? But because, you know, most of our city councils are nonpartisan anyway, so it's not a question of you know, whose program is right. It's a question of what priorities do you want your planning and zoning board to focus on? You know, what do you want them to shape your community like 20, 40 years from now? So those are some places where, again, as we turn next week, you know, today is day 11. You got your healthcare email this morning. You know, what do you want the healthcare system to look like so that particularly Black people who are just really underserved by the healthcare system that we have. It's just a statistical reality. Again, for reasons of implicit bias and for reasons of structural inequity. How would you want a healthcare system to be shaped so that that didn't happen anymore? So that's going to be, ultimately, our question is going to be, how are we going to use our privilege? How are we going to make that, you know, make things come out differently in the future?
I've got one comment that I picked up this week, probably by radio, because I spend so much time in the blood center van, I'm listening. But little did we know, in 2020, how approaching someone to run for the school board or approaching someone to run for your city council has a whole entire different meaning than what it had 10 years ago. You know, once in a while there'd be a flare. About the main thing I remember in school districts was consolidation. There was a lot of board members wondered, why did I ever go on the school board? Well, you know, there's a lot of parents, specifically the Des Moines school, being so reluctant to put kids back in the classroom. I mean, some of those school board members say, my God, I never thought about this part of the job when I agreed to it. And Des Moines City Council having protesters actually go to their homes. You know, 10 years ago, you encouraged somebody that run for the school board or the city council, never would have imagined any kind of activity that they've endured the last 8-10 months. I'm not one to run for political office or school board or dog catcher even. But generally, it wasn't real hard to talk a guy into running for school board or even city. I don't know about county offices. I've not been involved so much in a county run. But now you approach somebody, they're going to say, whoa, I'm not thinking I want to get on the school board. Thank you very much. Things have changed. We're not going back to the good old days of 2019 and earlier. Major. From 2020 forward, things are going to play out so different than what they did the prior 20 years. My prediction.
This is the year. Nobody put any of this in their five-year plan.
Oh, no.
That's right.
None of us imagined this.
So the I've been I don't usually listen to them because I'm usually like they happen on a Monday evening. And so I don't get to hear them, the Des Moines school board meetings you know, because my kids are in the Des Moines district and we've been sort of watching this play out, even though we know our kids are virtual all the way through the end of the semester. We already signed up for that. Mm-hmm. But I've got strong opinions about whether the state metrics are even remotely realistic. and so how the school board should be responding to that. So I'll go up upstairs after a class like this, and Leanne's listening to a school board meeting, because of course you can, you know, they were meeting exclusively online until last week, I think, a couple weeks ago maybe. And so the number of meetings that the Des Moines School Board had just over the last, over the last couple of months, exactly as you're saying, Warren, I would find out how long this meeting has been going on, and it's not over yet. And I'd think, how could they possibly have known what they were signing up for when they ran for that? Here's a plug for contact your local government officials. Can you imagine going through that process, not knowing how your constituents felt? Not knowing how your constituents felt about in the Des Moines School Board case, how to respond to the state guidelines, or even certainly the temperature has turned up a lot in terms of the, especially the Des Moines City Council people, but city council people, across the state and across the country. To have input from your constituents saying, hey, here's how I'd like you to respond to this, which does or does not have to include marching to somebody's house, I'm rarely going to say that someone shouldn't protest in any given way. I can say that there are plenty of ways I don't protest, because it's hard for me to speak authentically in a variety of different ways. But imagine trying to answer the problems that are presenting to just local governments, let alone your state legislators and your national legislators and your executive branch officials and so forth. Just imagine trying to take care of a city without having really good, thoughtful input from Presbyterians about how you can respond to some of these systemic structural issues that are really presenting themselves right now. Warren's off to take a phone call from his city council person right now.
Oh, I had the phone in another room, but I can still hear it. Yeah. Well, and I'm sure even on the state level, I'm sure Kim Reynolds, after being lieutenant governor and following Terry Branstad, she probably thought, well, why not? I might as well be governor. My God, how much TV time did she spend on those daily news conferences? I'll bet her hairdresser knows she's got gray hair. I tell you, there again, it's just a wake-up call, I think, that we're all concentrating maybe on the national level, but really, as far as affecting me or affecting you, that Des Moines School Board really was affecting the Williams family, and like I say, the city council, the mayor, I'm just picking on Des Moines here, but he was very doesn't he have a first door on Ingersoll? Maybe he's got the
time, right? Yeah,
to be in mayor. I can't imagine selling furs is a real in thing right now, but there again, who would have thought that the mayor of Des Moines, dealing with the police department, with those tear on live on TV, the mayor and the police captains trying to decide what to do. I don't know what the job pays, but to have to be under that kind of pressure, and as you say, not really sharing what his constituents wanted. He, I think, is willing to go what he thinks best and let the chips fall. I have to give him credit there. Whether he's got the majority opinion behind him in some of his decisions is yet to be determined. But yeah, it, this, like I say, this 2020, what, really not even in January, it was, you know, February to October, can't do them. Yeah, yeah, 10 or 11 months, and we're not out of it. To be right. continued. Yeah, I've got this novel, but I'm not sure how many chapters.
What was the phone alarm we got this morning on the snow?
Oh, about the snow squall.
Squall. I'm like, okay, that's a new one.
The Weather Bureau decided to warn us.
That's right. They warned us about the snow was going to cause low visibility in slick roads, which was true, but happy October, right?
Yeah.
I was going to text you and ask if we were going to postpone this due to bad weather.
That's right.
I always wondered if Des Moines ever imagined on their first day of school for elementary kids, they were going to have a snow day.
that's right. It was today.
Their
first day back. And no snow days this year. Everybody's pretty much said they're going virtual. Yeah. If the weather's bad, teachers will teach from home.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So that's a thing of the past now. That we've all figured this out.
Yeah.
Welcome to this brave new world, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, y'all. We've got healthcare and education. So today was healthcare. We've got two early childhood days, and then education more generally, and the justice system to wrap out our week. So.
Pretty heavy.
That's right. That's right.
To come. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.